actually really like Sarah. I think she's very resourceful. Like, she burns facts, and then she uses that ash to create a perfect smoky eye. Like, maybe she's born with it. Maybe it's lies. It's probably lies.
And that was the comic stylings of the previously unfamous comic Michelle Wolf at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And yes, we didn't want to talk about it, but since all you sons of so-and-sos are talking about it, we are going to be talking about it here on the Welcome to the Reason podcast. Hi, everyone. I am Matt Welch. This is your Monday version Editor's Roundtable of the ongoing Reason podcast, which you should all subscribe to on iTunes and rate and review us. And I think just based on the conversation that we have had for the last 5 minutes before we started this, that pretty soon we're going to offer a Patreon, if I'm pronouncing that right, account for the pre-show banter, premium subscription to hear about blood blisters, Kroger, LSD, and the bathroom habits of ex-Reason staffers. Okay, so we might need to bid that stuff up. But anyways, joining
current staffers is extra.
Super extra current staffers. That's Peter Suderman, who's barely alive in Washington, D.C., along with Catherine Mangu Ward. Nick Gillespie's in The Real America. Nick, you're in The Real America right now, right?
Yep. And I was talking about a health clinic in a Kroger, which also had a full clothing store as well. It was, you know,
was the clothing store between the food and the health clinic? Because that would make me feel better.
Yeah, it was.
Like, was it max? Was there like maximal distance between like raw meat and like pink eye?
No. I mean, the butcher station is in the clinic. Raw meat on your eye?
No, I think that's when someone punches you.
Yeah.
That's when you put the steak on your eye.
I mean, does it...
But it was like a glass cathedral to commerce, or like a mega church of commerce, this. It was in Kentucky, near the Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky airport. It was really spectacular.
Is this a fulfillment of the Idiocracy, where everything is under one giant roof? What was the name of the supermarket?
Well, it's Kroger. It's not Megalomart, right, which is like Mike Judge's Walmart Monkey from King of the Hill. Kroger is one of the oldest and biggest supermarket chains in America, and they have upped their game considerably over the past 20 years. I mean, they're for loose flour anymore.
Today's Reason podcast brought to you by Kroger.
So it's like Amazon, but in real life?
Yeah. IRL. Yeah.
Wow. Weird. So riddle me this, Nick. Was the discussion at Kroger as fervently all about the White House Correspondents' Dinner as Twitter freaking has been for the last 48 hours or however long since this stupid thing? No, seriously.
Yeah.
Did any single person outside in the real America be talking about this?
Well, in the stretch pant section of Kroger, and they devote a couple hundred thousand square feet to that. People were talking about it. No, of course not. That's one of the most amazing things about all of this. I do which is that very few people care about politics in general, much less the media as writ large, and nobody really cares about the White House Correspondents' Dinner very much, although it did become by sometime yesterday, and it might have crept up even further. It was already the third most watched YouTube video that C-SPAN has ever put out. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. So there is, and it was up to a couple of million and change views. So it does, I'm always happy to see comedians break through because create controversy, because it shows that at least there is still some kind of utopian surplus left in creative expression, whether it's poetry or comedy or music or literature. I've written about Michelle Wolf's set. I didn't think it was funny. I didn't think it was offensive, but it's kind of great that it breaks through and you know, if we're talking about it, which I guess we are, the thing that was amazing to me is that the, you know, the conservative response to it was like, oh, that's not funny. And she's making fun of abortion, which is not funny. So conservatives were kind of being PC, you know, that's not funny types. But it was the press corps which went bananas over her thing, you know, and the head, the outgoing head of the White House Press Correspondents Association said that this was counter to the spirit of the event, which was supposed to celebrate free speech and First Amendment protections, right? Yeah, so that, like, you know, somebody pissing people off is a problem. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize winner, newly minted Pulitzer Prize winner, was saying it is unconscionable for women to make fun of other women's appearance, which she did a bit, Wolf did a bit to Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And, you know, there were a bunch of other people who were like, oh, this was awful from the press corps. And it's I just don't get that.
Watching them wince and listening to them in the clip that we opened the show with, listening to them audibly go, oh, in the audience is probably the only if I am going to watch this, which I won't do. Beyond the clips, that's what I would watch it for, because it's just so ridiculous. Catherine, Nick brought up being a lady, can lady comics make fun of the makeup of lady spokespeople?
Wolf has taken to Twitter to note that she referred to Sarah Huckabee Sanders' makeup as the perfect smoky eye, which, if you were a lady, you would know is the highest compliment. So actually,
what does it mean? Can you translate that into man?
Yeah. So it's like when you put on eyeliner and then dark eyeshadow, so you look sort of like smoky and mysterious. Like, oh, my eyes are dark and made up because I'm doing exciting evening activities.
I guess it's like the equivalent of, like, I've got really cool speakers that I'm going to...
it's not like that at all.
I thought we were trying to translate this into man.
Nope, because cool ladies do it.
Okay, so...
and cool speakers...
I feel like my metaphor is working out.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, so anyway, she complimented the smoky eye, which is important. You're not allowed to talk about people's looks. Hysteria always strikes me as quite weird, like... you know, she was mostly criticizing her moral status and also professional and personal choices, which you would think people would be more upset about if they thought that those choices were good ones. I actually thought the best
Cousin Huckabee too.
Well, she did talk about Sarah Huckabee Sanders as Aunt Lydia from The Handmaid's Tale, and Aunt Lydia is a not a good-looking woman either. So,
but you know what, Nick? That's on you if you think the main thing about Aunt Lydia is her looks. She's also like a deeply morally evil human, right?
I agree with that, yeah. No. I'm a big fan of...
Aunt Lydia?
No, I was going to say of Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales. And, like, you know, we know from medieval literature that people's physiognomy reflects the torment of their inner soul. So
so what is your blood blister on your foot?
Yeah, it means
so
that I've got a lot of I've got to buy some indulgences and start praying.
I'm pretty sure you have too much phlegmatic bile or something.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. Red bile.
No, I actually thought the best joke in the set was the Jake Tapper joke, which didn't get any play anywhere because no one could really be offended by it, where she suggested that Jake Tapper's orgasm face would just be thoughtful furrowed brow, and then he would say,
"Yeah, that's all we have time for."
That's all we have time for.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen her go like full Broca on that, because,
never go full Broca.
Yeah.
No, in general, I thought they're always bad. These stand-up comedians are always bad. They're being asked to do an impossible thing. They always do it badly. This was the same bad as always, as far as I can tell.
I thought Stephen Colbert in 2006 at the White House Correspondents' Dinner was pretty good, where he really did, like, attack Bush in his Stephen Colbert from the Colbert Report character. I thought that was good. And then there were a couple of things, Matt, you may remember these from the 90s, and it was actually the radio and television correspondents' dinners, but they had, in back-to-back years, they had Don Imus and Norm Macdonald talking about Bill Clinton, who was sitting next to them. And those were also, people were totally flabbergasted and just horrified that you would actually tell somewhat mean-spirited jokes although often accurate, as was Michelle Wolff's, about politicians while they were sitting right there. And again, I mean, I think all of this stuff should disappear because it just is unseemly to me, particularly for journalists to be chummy with the people they cover. I mean, it's going to happen and all of that kind of stuff, but it's like something out of late Rome, you know, the late Roman Empire. It just is like.
But in that way, this year's was better, right? The president didn't go. The celebrity quotient was way down. Like it was actually just basically a normal industry banquet where the press got together and patted itself on the back, which all industries do.
Yeah, but it's also bad. And I did a bit of reading about it. And there was a moment in like 1944 where Bob Hope hosted or he performed and he did a bunch of Wendell Willkie jokes. And it's just a bad event all the way around. You know, journalists don't need to flatter themselves so much.
This has been called for some years, referred to as nerd prom. But if I'm not mistaken, Peter, isn't that what we used to call AEI's annual dinner, where there was actual kind of like wonk people who really were nerds and didn't know how to dress even worse than actual White House correspondents?
Nerd prom inflation is real. It's the kind of expansion of nerd prom. Like everything is nerd prom. Soon, like this podcast will be called nerd prom. Yeah, the nerd prom started with.
I did a really nice smoky eye for this podcast, so I'm ready.
Did you burn lies really, in order to get that smoke? I
always do. Yeah, but only in the pre-show. I think the prom aspect is really what's worth focusing on because that's what this is. This is a sort of annual social occasion for, as Catherine says, a kind of industry group. It's a little bit larger than just the press corps. It's the kind of there's a sort of beltway elite or sort of beltway power player aspect to it. And, you know, Nick has written sort of that the whole thing needs to go away. I think I suppose I wouldn't mind if it all went away. What I really would like is just for it to get out of the public eye because it doesn't deserve any more attention than any other large social industry gathering or large gathering of high school students, because that's basically what this is. And then, of course, somebody does something that's sort of shocking that everybody's talking about, you know, in the hallways, in the locker rooms, whatever, the next day. And like if it weren't the press corps, if it weren't the, you know, sort of the most influential people in the national political press, no one would really be talking about this stuff. And for a while, there was a kind of a veneer of an excuse, which is that the president would attend. And so anything the president does is kind of by definition news. And the president isn't there anymore. And yes, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was, but it's not really an event that is at this point. It's not really an event that is endorsed by sort of fully participated in by the administration. It is just an event for the press to talk to and about itself. And that's great. That's fine. If the press wants to do that, I don't mind. I don't mind people who go and who enjoy these sorts of things, who want to dress up and be fancy with their friends. I think I've had friends who've gone in the past. I certainly had people had friends this year who were celebrating it at the pre and after parties and perhaps were there themselves. But the thing is, it doesn't need to be an object of national discussion afterwards. And the sort of and if it were any other group, even of famous people, besides perhaps, I don't know, you know, the Oscars or something like that, for any other group, it just wouldn't be because the stuff is just ends up being so kind of trivial and pointless.
Although I will say, I thought you were totally setting up us to talk about the post that just went live by Nick on Reason.com, which is the whole country getting upset about what someone did at a high school prom, which is just a gathering of people that nobody really cares about, that they turned into political controversy for its own sake. Nick, you want to tell us what we're not allowed to wear to prom?
Yeah. Ladies, particularly white women from Salt Lake City, white girls shouldn't be wearing Chinese dresses, Chinese style dresses. And that caused a kind of conflagration on Twitter over the weekend because a girl posted out pictures of herself in that, and a Chinese American man tweeted back saying, "My culture is not your fucking prom dress." And, you know, a discussion ensued, which I actually thought was pretty good. I thought it was illuminating and ultimately useful. And I celebrate Twitter for creating a space both where everybody can say whatever they want and occasionally good conversations can break out.
I want to make a podcast confession here, which is that to my homecoming dance, I wore in high school what we then called a Suzy Wong dress well. So I'm part of the problem.
Was a Suzy Wong a name or is it just sort of like
from a movie shorthand called The World of Suzy Wong, which Bill Shatner had a small part in, by the way. But it's Shatner. a Bill Holden movie. And it was a Broadway play as well. Bill Holden and I believe Jack Sue, Matt, who you loved on Barney Miller as a detective, was there.
Mostly because of the episode where they eat pot brownies.
Yeah,
which is go YouTube it, people, because Jack Sue
mushy.
Before we leave the topic, I have a unified theory of this all. It's only going to take me 15 minutes to get through. But no, Peter, we can't ignore this. It cannot be ignored because of the kind of analog to what we describe in coastal cities in California, New York, as like the barbell economy. You know, like it's the economy is really heavy on the rich and heavy on the poor end, and there's only kind of a little bit of a middle class sort of a thing. Well, think of Washington in particular, not as a barbell, but as a sledgehammer, in the way that sledgehammers are completely weighted on an end. As more of American life, money, and interest all flows into Washington, which it has all over Washington.
It's like the goddamn Hunger Games, Matt.
Yes, Nick. As that end of journalism becomes richer, more in our lives, as we can't really ignore politics nearly as much, and as journalism itself becomes much more national focused, not local focused, people flood into. Jack Shaver had a great piece, a study actually last year, talking about how journalists have just like fled all towns and have all moved to New York. Basically, there's been this weird leveling, so that they all kind of congregate.
Hey, that's where you live.
Heavy blue state
Wait,
areas.
Really?
No, Matt's in New York? I think Matt's in Slovakia, isn't it? Matt, aren't you calling in from Bratislava?
He's in Armenia right now.
All the journalists moved to New York, says a journalist who moved to New York.
I'm just quoting the Washington legend.
It's really true. There's been
a
local journalism jobs, and basically all the journalism jobs have gone to New York and D.C.
Yeah, like new internet, you know, BuzzFeed type of things. And because this is all part of our political culture media war, which consumes ever more of our kind of, I think, 6 out of the top 10 Twitter trending topics at some point were having to do with the White House Correspondents' Dinner. That shows that Twitter is a cesspool of dumb political journalists, and they're the ones who ruined all of it.
Twitter is losing daily users. I wouldn't use Twitter for anything other than a sign of failure. A synecdoche of failing.
It's
failing
going to be
media.
With us. We can't ignore it. That's the world we live in. The world we live in is getting worse. So speaking of getting worse, let's talk about something that might get better, which is while people are talking about nothing more than kind of gossip of media and manners disputes of our ruling class. Meanwhile, like North Korea and South Korea are like ending their war or coming close to it. Huge summit meeting. North Korea has just announced that it's going to shift its time zone to align with South Korea. They apparently shifted it 30 minutes away previously because, man, we're not going to be unified in time zones.
That is so gloriously petty, by the way.
It's like, great.
That's the kind of war we should be having. It should just be pure symbolic time zone burns.
So they had a big meeting. The North Korea is offering to give up its nuclear program in exchange for an American pledge not to attack. They've dropped the demand, apparently, as a precondition to demand of all the U.S. troops be withdrawn from the DMZ, setting up a May or June meeting with Donald Trump. President Trump's talking about is tweeting, obviously, that maybe it would be a good idea to meet in the DMZ itself. That would be kind of historic and cool. Even Adam Schiff, is out there saying that I think it's more than fair to say that the combination of the president's unpredictability and bellicosity had something to do with the North Koreans deciding to come to the table. So are we all excited? Nick, you're friends with Eli Lake. Are we licking up Eli's delicious tears in this? Is it too premature to be hopeful about all that?
Yeah, I mean, to stick up for Eli, but he was merely saying that we've been close to this before and right. Something always happens. But I think
like it's, four times before.
I think it's pretty, you know, fascinating. And I think it's clear that Trump had something to do with this to the extent that, you know, it's moving forward and things like that. I think it's kind of great. And I like the idea if, you know, I mean, I'm on my hobby horse and I'm going to work it in as much as I can that, like, you know, we need the 21st century to fucking start already. And like nothing exemplifies the stalemate of dead, stupid, backward looking policies than North Korea and South Korea, as well as the American presence there. We've been, we've been there since the late 40s. For God's sake. So I'm all in favor of this kind of stuff, and I hope it goes forward. I think that there are reasons to think that it will. The part that I don't think has been looked at enough is, you know, North Korea is by virtually every account a Chinese client state. So we need to look at the ways in which U.S.-China relations are affecting any kind of interactions that are going on among the hermit kingdoms, North and South. And I don't think we've done that yet.
Catherine, the people have been talking about the condition of U.S. troop withdrawal for dropping a nuke program and also declaring a formal end of the war instead of the kind of armistice that we're still holding to 60 years later. And I understand in the point of negotiations that you don't want to drop your negotiating tools, but like, isn't that not a bad idea? Like, yeah, okay, we'll take our 30,000 troops home and you won't have the nukes and we'll not be at war with one another. Doesn't that sound like a pretty like reasonable outline of a deal?
It sounds like a pretty reasonable outline of a deal to me. I think, you know, the idea that the U.S. needs to retain massive, heavily armed presences in places where we completed our, you know, formal war-like engagements many, many decades before is a totally bizarre one. Like, we have a huge presence in Germany, which has now evolved to have many other functions, but our presence in the Koreas is not nearly as useful as the base in Germany, and it makes perfect sense to say, like, hey, maybe let's not do that anymore. I want to say, though, that this week was the week of gloriously awkward world leader handshaking. Like, I don't know if you guys watched the video of this sort of like dance back and forth across the North Korean South Korean border where Kim Jong-un.
I think they're playing jump the broom.
Yeah, I mean, I think they might be married in like some African American cultures now. Like the handshake.
So
followed by the stepping across, and then like it's unclear to me whether it was actually choreographed or whether it was spontaneous. I assume it was choreographed because I wouldn't do anything spontaneous in the DMZ.
No, but it was. And it was actually
I know we're being told it was spontaneous, but like, is that really real? I don't know. Anyway, the offering of the hand and then the hand holding of President Moon and Kim Jong-un to sort of walk together back and forth across the line, rivaled only by Trump's greeting of Macron at the podium that had the high five, fist bump, cheek kiss, snuggle, snuggle move.
Reach around.
It seems like shaking the hand of another world leader should be the first thing they teach you in president school, but apparently not.
I think Trump has disrupted the game. You know, it was the first Trump Macron handshake, the awkward elbow tug of war that they had at the NATO summit, out there. And then afterwards, Macron was like talking about it a lot. Well, it was very important to show that I would not shake the hand the way that the other people do, and the masculines and the and he going. So now everyone's completely self-conscious about it. Peter, you're ready to give Donald Trump a Nobel Peace Prize. Will you be the one to deliver it to him?
I've been working on this speech this weekend. It's actually, I've been thinking of delivering it in the voice of Thanos. I think
I'm really surprised we made it this far into the podcast without an Avengers reference.
I actually prefer the photo of Trump and Macron digging the tree in the White House garden, which then mysteriously disappeared. No one knew where it was.
Fake news.
But then they found it. Apparently, it was placed in a quarantine after they dug up a hole and quasi planted
it. Was it a French tree? Did they bring the tree from France?
They brought a gift tree.
It has to go
they
to
planted
so
it.
Did we quarantine the Statue of Liberty when they gave us that thing? I mean, come on, guys.
And then now it's
the regulatory state, man.
It's basically going through like immigration processing. And
oh
it's
my God,
probably,
is it getting extreme vetting?
As much as anything in the Trump White House, including his cabinet members,
the Tree of Liberty has to be watered now and again with extreme vetting,
with extreme disinfectants, and also antimicrobials,
extreme fertilizer.
Yeah. So look, I think that we should be hopeful here. I think that an optimism is both warranted and good. There are, however, some reasons to be a little bit skeptical, namely that we've seen, you know, back in 2012, we basically saw this from North Korea, where they said we're going to stop the nuclear tests. They haven't said that they are going to take any irreversible steps yet. And that's really the kind of line that we want both, that we want all sides to be crossing here, is taking a step that you can't easily undo. And that shows a real commitment. And we haven't gotten there yet. That's not to say that we're not going to get there. It's not to say that we can't at all. But we should, I think, you know, while being optimistic and hopeful, we should also sort of recognize that these sorts of deals are very difficult to get over the finish line, and that really requires an awful lot of risk, you know, taking on both sides. I will say, though, that if we're going to give a Nobel Peace Prize, we maybe shouldn't give it to Trump. Instead, we should possibly give it to the North Korean nuclear scientists who built the missiles that scared the hell out of the world and in part made this possible. Now, I don't want to say that I think that that is a great thing. Because it's not. I would prefer, all else being equal, I would prefer for there to be fewer and fewer and perhaps even zero nuclear weapons in this world. On the other hand, in this case, that does seem to be part of the equation, is that the growing nuclear strength of North Korea has contributed to making this moment of discussion possible in ways that I think are sort of interesting and complicate some of the peace narratives that folks have sort of that folks who want peace have had.
A nuclear society is a polite society, Peter.
In the end, Heinlein is right about everything.
Yeah, Heinlein and Bill Burroughs, who was fond of saying armed societies are polite societies. I think there's a lot of truth to that, actually.
This is happening in the exact backdrop of another nuclear deal that might be kind of unraveling, which is the May 12th deadline of the Iran nuclear deal sanctions decision by Donald Trump. Macron was in town. Angela Merkel was also in town, in part to try to lobby Trump to not impose sanctions on this six-country Iran nuclear deal. Very bizarre kind of thing to me, and I don't claim to understand any of this. But enough to read some reporting on it. But Trump keeps saying it's the worst deal ever. It's the worst deal ever. And declared formally last October, he decertified the deal by saying Iran is not living up to its end. Meanwhile, everyone who formally studies compliance of this, including people like, I don't know, Defense Secretary James Mattis, says that, you know what, Iran is complying with this deal. And so the worry is that May 12th deadline that Trump is going to decide to slap sanctions, which will in turn unravel this. Can you make any sense of what the seeming incoherence of that, Nick? Is it another case of the Trump campaign rhetoric, which is way out on some ledge over here. And then now we have to sort of like bend reality backwards to try to see if it matches up, and it's not happening. What's your sense of the seeming incoherence of approach towards a denuclearization regime?
That's a very good question. I'm going to try to pull myself out of this hellhole you just plunged me into, Matt, by actually referencing Eli Lake. I talked to him about the nuclear deal or the Iran deal at one point when it was happening. And, you know, one of the things that he pointed out was, you know, and he was against the deal. A lot of people were against the deal because it didn't finalize decisions that were going to take place well into the future about whether or not Iran would be able to restart its nuclear ambitions in a, you know, after a decade or whatever. But part of the, you know, part of what we need to do with Iran, which is massively complicated by the war in Syria and the way that the U.S. is, you know, trying to both be in and outside of Syria and Iraq and all of the superpowers and allies that come into play with that, because, you know, you've got Russia, which is backing Iran, which is backing Syria. You've got Russia backing Syria, which is also a client state in many cases, in many ways, of Iran. There's Turkey for the United States that we got to deal with, as well as Iraq and whatnot. It gets very complicated. But in terms of sanctions and things like that, one of the things that is really helpful is the, you know, we still have protests going on in Iran. We've stopped covering them, partly because the U.S. doesn't have access to, you know, on the ground reporting and stuff like that going on in Iran. But it's fascinating that people in Iran are absolutely fed up with corrupt mullahs who are not, you know, they are, the people by all accounts are fed up with the religiosity and the, you know, the kind of spiritual dimension that is being, you know, pushed on people, but also that these people are liars and hypocrites, that they're taking money and shipping it out of the country. And that's a place where all sorts of kind of sanctions can be levied against specific people in the Iranian regime, and that actually has proven effective in a number of cases where you make it very difficult for rulers or well-connected people who are essentially trying to get money out of a country so that they can set up, you know, Swiss bank accounts and you know, other places that they want to end up. You can do that, and that's all to the good.
Peter, you live in Washington, D.C., unlike Catherine, who lives in Washington, D.C. I was struck by the difference between the Macron and Merkel meetings. It felt from afar that Macron was there for like a week and a half. The most insane photographs, I think, in the history of summitry came from that, especially Brigitte Macron putting her hand on the shaft of Donald Trump's shovel. And I know that sounds like I'm being creepy, but you got to look at the photo. It's creepier than ever. But essentially, Macron and Merkel were saying the same exact thing to Trump. Trump was giving the same exact answer, both on the Iran nuclear deal and more importantly, perhaps, or more pressingly, the steel and aluminum tariffs, which will go into place at midnight unless Trump decides to exempt them after having talked to everyone. So first, just coin toss, Peter, do you think at the last minute Trump is going to exempt the European Union from steel and aluminum tariffs on a whim, or is he not?
I have no idea. I mean, I think your coin toss is just as good as my answer. So let's go with yes. Actually, no, let's go with no. Let's go with no, because it's a coin toss and I'm picking no. Because that's how coin tosses. I have no idea what Trump's going to do, because no one ever has any idea what Trump's going to do. I think the difference in coverage was largely about the fact that Macron, the optics were staged to generate a different sort of coverage, and you just didn't see the sort of like Merkel walking around downtown and planting trees and, you know, all that sort of stuff in a way that was designed to generate a lot of imagery. And statecraft is part imagery, you know, is sort of is image management in a lot of ways. And there's also just sort of something kind of sexily attractive to the D.C. press corps about French foreign leaders in a way that, like, kind of neoliberal German consensus monger Angela Merkel. It just isn't.
Catherine, in the First Lady War between Brigitte and Melania, who brought it the best?
That's another lady question for me.
Absolutely.
Melania's hat was the greatest thing that's happened in Washington.
My God.
Just glorious.
My God, was that a hat?
Just glorious. If you'd put a little bit of netting on it, she could have also doubled as a beekeeper, which I think is, that's probably Michelle Obama left some hives somewhere on the property that they're going to discover soon. So that's good. In the matchup of ladies who came to D.C., I'm obviously going to be Team Merkel. Like, she's the bomb here. I think the fact that she kind of came in stealth had this,
not in the North Korean sense.
Not
right?
in the North Korean sense, in the da bomb sense. She came in stealth, basically made sound arguments to keep trade as open as possible, bailed the hell back out. I think obviously the EU attempting to get exemptions to a bad U.S. trade policy is not my preferred mode. I would rather not have bad U.S. trade policy in the first place. If you want to read all about how very, very bad Trump's trade policy is, particularly the steel and aluminum tariffs, you could check out The Issue of Reason, which should be landing in your mailbox right now if you're a subscriber. Everybody check that off on your bingo card. I just touted the print magazine. I vote yes. I think Trump is going to, because he saw some people face to face and maybe they were the last people who managed to say the decisive thing to him, and because it will be an exciting last minute turn of events, I think the EU is going to get its exemption.
Nick, Trump gave a speech while the White House Correspondents' Dinner or held a rally, did the Trump thing as counter programming, and in that said, among other things, that the EU is basically launched to defy, to undermine America, and to take advantage of us in trade, and that's not true, Nick.
Yeah.
It's not remotely true. It's the opposite. It is anti-true. The U.S. totally wanted there to be a free trade zone in Western Europe. It was kind of our idea of how to create a bulwark of against communism, how to create a capitalist kind of cell there, and also let them kind of rebuild. Should I stop going crazy over this kind of stuff?
Isn't it at some point
embarrassing?
It's embarrassing, Matt. You're embarrassing. Yes. Do you have any other questions? I agree with you. I just wanted to point out before we completely leave it behind, the picture of Macron, Monsieur Macron, and President Trump and their wives burying that tree on the yard. Somebody on Twitter said it's like the perfect cover for a Pink Floyd album that hasn't been released yet, which is very much true. I just wanted to bring that up. And then the other thing is, the common market, it was never, in its earliest days, was never an attack on America. It was a way of facilitating free trade and kind of common objectives among free Europe. And it was very much done as a post-war thing with American blessing to kind of keep Europe free, or that part which was still free, out of the clutches of the Soviet Union. And even the EU, when it became a full-fledged union, it was still not a bad thing for the United States, except, and it's worth pointing out that one of the arguments for Brexit was that the EU had never really, it was supposed to be brokering free trade deals with North America and with other broad trade zones, and it never seemed to get around to it, which is kind of interesting. But
yeah, it was more of a focus.
Having said that, Trump, this is part of it's not part of the problem. It is the problem with Trump's vision of the world, which is that there is no such thing as gains from trade. There is only, kind of competition where you're either fucking over the other person or they're fucking you over. And that is understandable, or it's like that kind of psychology makes sense for the type of businessman that Trump was. It's not a good, it's not necessarily a good thing from a president of a country. Again, having said all of that, Trump's trade program, trade policies are terrible in general, like his immigration policies and many other things. But he is hemmed in somewhat. And even when we're talking about stuff like steel and aluminum tariffs from the EU, he made it pretty clear. I'm pretty confident that he's going to exempt everybody, you know, from these tariff deals, because in the end, he is kind of a pussy when it comes to this type of stuff. He rarely goes all the way out. But I think particularly with Europe, he's going to exempt them.
One of the interesting pre-Macron visit kind of press coverage things of it, Macron has figured out to get on Trump's good side by calling him in the morning, according to my French friends who live in Washington. So like, he calls him during executive time and kind of butters him up and shoots the breeze. That Trump had expressed to Macron, that Paris agreement that I pulled out of, maybe we can negotiate our way back in. And Macron's like, that's not how that works, really. In the TPP is kind of a similar thing. Trump has the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which Trump pulled out of right before America was supposed to go in. He has since said, maybe we'll try to get back in. And people are having to tell him that multilateral negotiations are complicated things. They take many, many years and rounds, and you can't just press a button or flip a switch on this stuff. And that's kind of what worries me, because his statements, fantastical, oftentimes based on bad understandings of things, tend to be very binary, flip a switch type of things. And it's all about him being a negotiator, and then come to find out, he's got kind of buyer's remorse here. And trade deals are exactly like that. So I hope we're not in a situation where he makes the wrong decision tonight before midnight on this, and then later on says, we can just flip the switch. The world doesn't work like that. And it's distressing that this is a kind of a mindset and set of understandings about the world still of a president who has people around him telling him like that it doesn't work that way. It's kind of bums me out. That's what I'm trying to say, Nick. Let's make a hard pivot away from the world and diplomacy thereof. And
that's what Trump said.
Thank you for that. And kind of knit it all back to the culture and our 2020 candidate. Maybe he's going to be a 2024 candidate, who is obviously Kanye West, who's dropping truth bombs on Twitter, strafing the world with truth bombs on Twitter.
This guy's actually dropping more bombs than Michelle Wolf at a White House correspondent dinner, Matt.
Exactly. And provoking kind of interesting conversations, Chance the Rapper came out and said,
more bombs than Barack Obama secretly in Afghanistan.
Wow.
More Yemen. More bombs than McLean Stevenson laid on sitcom TV in the 1970s.
Laid on sitcom TV. Nick, you wrote about Chance the Rapper saying that not all black people have to be Democrats. Mm-hmm. And kind of the conversation that ensued, including the huge backlash against such sentiments in Kanye. Expositorianus.
What is that, a Harry Potter curse?
I think so.
You get frozen in place and you just have to listen to someone talk for as long as they can.
Jesus, story of my life. it's very interesting because, Liz Nolan Brown just put up a piece of Reason today earlier that showed that Democrats are losing millennial voters at the same rate that Republicans are, and that basically at this point, even from a year ago, millennials equally now hate Republicans and Democrats, which I see as a great triumph of generational warfare. But Chance the Rapper, who's based in Chicago, he's highly Christian and all of that. He's given money to public schools and to other kinds of experimental school policy. In D.C., he talked about Kanye West as his mentor and homie. He supported Kanye when Kanye started saying kind of off the wall kinds of stuff. And at one point he said, black people don't have to be Democrats. And he took a lot of shit for that. And he started to walk it back. But he, even in his walk back, he said, I was taught, it was the wrong time to say that. because Trump's a piece of shit, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here. But that, you know, from his personal experience growing up in bad parts of Chicago, you know, he doesn't have a lot of love, Chance. He doesn't have a lot of love for the police or for schools because they never do anything for black people. And I think that's great. Republican Twitter or conservative Twitter was very happy to take that and run with it. That's the wrong attitude, because this isn't a zero sum game where it's like, if, you know, if the Democrats lose black votes, there's no reason for them to go to the Republican Party, which has been hostile to them, both as individuals, as well as, you know, members of a group, as well as just, you know, at best, not giving a shit about black Americans' experience in the economy, in schools, in the drug war. You know, this what is most exciting about it, and I think this is legitimately true about Kanye West, who is also, by the way, a master marketer. He's got a bunch of albums coming out and has really kicked off a huge amount of interest in him by tweeting out things where he's interested in conservatives and he's interested in Scott Adams, the Dilbert creator, and all of this kind of stuff.
He tweeted some Jordan Peterson videos.
Yeah.
But let's be clear here. He tweeted iPhone video of him. YouTube video that he was watching on a computer.
As one does.
No, but I mean, Kanye is, you know, his whole thing, you know, is that, like, you don't have to be a captive to the thinking or the categories you've inherited. And I think that that's really true. And I think you see that kind of rumbling through some of Chance the Rapper's comments as well. And it's really, to me, it's actually exciting because these are, you know, people in a cultural space where they are not saying, I've got to leave the Democrats, so I'm going to become a Republican. It's like they're saying the Republicans aren't good for us and the Democrats aren't either. And so they're, you know, therein lies the possibility of new sets of identities, both for people like them, but also for the Republicans and Democrats. Things have to change. And then you throw in the stuff that Liz was writing about this morning at Reason.com. It's very exciting. The wheels are falling off the 20th century, you know, and something is starting to come into possibility that wasn't there even a few years ago, I think.
I think, though, all this Kanye stuff just speaks to your contrarianism, Nick. Like, I don't think of myself as a contrarian. And obviously, you know, this is, I feel like the Kanye kerfuffle, which
actually,
we are going to call it.
You're
from
pretty
now
contrarian,
on.
Catherine.
Fuck you. Yeah. The Kanye kerfuffle, as it shall henceforth be known, is a great example of how contrarianism is an effective short-term publicity generating strategy and a desperately ineffective long-term doing things strategy.
I'm not asking Kanye
to do my political things, right? I think he's perfectly allowed to do this as a marketing activity, but I think you know, libertarians can fall into the trap of, like, everybody just flipped their shit when I said something. It must have been great. And sometimes it's not great.
Well,
so there's some history here that's worth kind of going into a little bit. And like Kanye has been offline for over a year. He's been doing, it's sort of unclear what. And so part of this is that it's a return to his sort of, you know, it's a return to his public presence. It's not just that it's somebody who has been out there saying stuff and suddenly decided at one point to say something that was totally crazily opposite of what he usually says. In fact, over a year ago, sort of during the Trump campaign and when Trump was being elected, he had photos with Donald Trump in the bottom of Trump Tower.
Which resulted
got some
in
right. And
those
so this
photos
is,
were glorious, like the photos that looked like Kanye was like the resentful teenage stepson being photographed next to Donald Trump. But
and
he
had totally chosen to be there. The
one of the
here
reasons
that worth,
he went
that
silent
is important
well.
to single out the difference here that is important is that this isn't just sort of marketing contrarianism for its own sake leading to nothing. With Kanye West, with artists who do this, whether or with sort of public persons who do this sort of thing, the question always is, does the work stand up? Are they actually sort of delivering on the substance? And to me, Kanye West does very, very consistently. He has released no bad albums. My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy is probably the best album of this decade. He's got a couple more things coming out. Yes, we have not heard them yet, and so maybe they'll be garbage fires. On the other hand, this is a guy with an incredible track record of just groundbreaking, substantive work. And so if he wants to market it by saying, hey, look at me, I'm just a crazy weirdo who's willing to go and do stuff that other people won't do, that's kind of on brand. It's kind of interesting. It's, you know, it's I mean, it doesn't strike me as kind of as shallow contrarianism that doesn't get us anything. It strikes me as a clever marketing ploy.
But it forces all of his peers who have not mastered this balance of I am just a crazy weirdo genius who does my own thing to deal with it on a more surface or literal level. And that's how we get these Chance the Rapper, my fault, yo, tweets. And this is how we get John Legend up in his text messages with the screenshots going. Like, there is a lot of people who responded to it on its own terms, which is maybe part of the marketing, but also is part of the political discussion.
Sure. And I'm actually not super interested in Kanye's political views one way or the other, you know, whether he's a Donald Trump supporter or whether he's kind of Donald Trump curious or whatever it is. I'm interested in the music. And to me, if this sort of this suggests, hey, I'm trying to build attention for the music, I'm a huge fan of his music. I have been for a decade plus now. And so if this is a way to build attention for the music, I think that that's probably pretty good. I do think it's a mistake, though, to judge the music based on the tweets. And that is what
I'm not going to judge the music at all.
So I'm not saying that you're doing that.
But I think it's, you know, the other thing that comes out of this is the sentence, black people don't have to be Democrats. And then we talk about that. And you could say that that's good, I guess.
It's a great thing.
The other thing, though, that's really important here is Chance the Rapper's real name is Chancellor, which I need everyone to know.
I was going to say that, you know, the musical guest or the cultural person that Kanye West actually most reminds me of, not obviously in terms of the type of music he does, but it's Bob Dylan. I just don't want to read him any more than I read Dylan as cynically or even explicitly or consciously making ploys. Dylan, of course, is you know, famous for shedding his fan base or challenging his fan base, you know, every 5 to 10 years and say, you thought you knew me. I'm going in a totally different direction. And do you want to come with me? And I think the most spectacular and trying thing was not when Dylan went electric in the late 60s, but rather when he went full Christian, like evangelical, Bible thumping, you know, you are being thrown into a lake of hellfire for all eternity if you don't believe Jesus is your personal Lord and Savior, in the late 70s on albums like Slow Train Coming, which were fantastic. And Kanye West strikes me as that he has a journey he's going on, and he invites people to come along, and it's pretty spectacular. And I do think he is that level of figure in popular music, like a Dylan level figure. And I think Peter certainly would agree with me on that. What I find interesting about cultural figures is that at times, and you know, the discourse, provided outside of their art form by most cultural creators, whether they're novelists or musicians or playwrights or whatever, is banal and retarded beyond belief. But they do occasionally open up the space for people being able to think differently about who they are in things like politics. And I do think the takeaway from all of this flap is the idea of black saying, hey, you know what, like black people don't have to be Democrats. It also means, among other things, that and we're seeing some of this on the right, Christians don't have to be fucking right wing Republicans. I find it fascinating and kind of wonderful that a lot of Christians are saying, you know what, Jesus, if you take him seriously and if you take him at his word, it's about helping poor people and it's about kissing lepers and it's about not acquiring good things in this world, but rather giving succor to the helpless. And so you see that as well, going in another direction. And I love that. I love the idea that people are getting around to the idea that, look, all of these identities are much looser or more potentially varied
more
than we've ever thought. Yeah, you know, and it allows for different types of conversations. It allows for different kinds of coalitions. Matt, you and I talked about this a lot in the Declaration of Independence. That, you know,
Bingo!
we can try. You know, we can be lots of different things over the course at any given moment in our lives, as well as through the course of our lives. And I think that's very liberating, and I think it's very, very exciting.
Nick, you might have had some other piece of cultural effluvia in mind for our end of show, what are you consuming bit. But I wanted to ask you if you've consumed the new Bob Dylan issue that goes through his Jesus years. I think it's a series of live kind of performances and booklets and that kind of stuff. Have you checked that out?
Yeah, I have, and it's if you like Dylan, it's extremely exciting. He I mean Dylan, you know, and I realize I will be very sad for a long time when he's finally gone, but he is Walt Whitman. Fuck Walt Whitman. You know, Walt Whitman is not as good a Walt Whitman as Bob Dylan is. He's vast and he contains multitudes, certainly contradicts himself. And it's, you know, he has explored virtually every aspect of American experience. And, you know, and those recordings are really, really sharp.
If you wanted to add another one, that's fine, too. But if not, I will see what I'm
reading. Yeah, I'm just reading the Hellfire Club by Jake Tapper, Tapper's novel, which is pretty interesting, and it's I haven't finished it yet, so I'm not sure where ultimately I'll end up on it. But it's a really interesting kind of engagement with all sorts of weird stuff that was happening in the 50s, including McCarthyism, but also a lot of stuff beyond that, and it's so far so good.
Like the comic book scare, right? In the middle of that.
Yeah, the 50s are one of the most, and I'm sorry to go on, it's but the 50s
that's why
are
we're
one
here,
of,
Nick.
The 50s are one of the greatest decades because retroactively they were defined by the 60s as gray and stolid and uninteresting. There was so much going on there, including like when you look back at what was being published in the 50s, it was all about how American civilization was coming to an end. How did we manage to beat the Nazis only to defeat ourselves through getting fat, through reading comic books, through Johnny not being able to read, et cetera. And like why we're killing ourselves through consumerism. There was so much anxiety and terror in the 50s. When you look back on it, it really helps you understand all of the moral panics that we're constantly having since then are nothing new. It's just kind of a baseline condition in American life, at least since the end of World War II, where we reached a certain level of wealth and comfort that we can now, it's almost like moral panics are a luxury good and we can afford them now. And the 50s helps us understand that and understand why we should not, why we should be skeptical about all of these fears that the world is about to end because X, Y, and Z is happening.
Peter, what can you spoil for us about Infinity War for those of us who will never see it, even under threat of extinction?
Literally everything, but I'm not going to spoil anything because it's already all over the internet. If you want the big spoilers, and there are some, if you want the big spoilers, they're already out there. I saw it last week. It's pretty good. It's kind of amazing even that it is pretty good given the task that it has for itself, which is to somehow juggle and combine something literally like 70 superhero characters who have been kind of accumulating in the nooks and crannies and crevices of the Marvel Universe now for literally a decade. The very first film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe was Iron Man, which came out the first weekend of May in 2008. So we are almost exactly 10 years out now. And it's all been kind of leading up to this film. The very end of the Avengers teases Thanos is coming and finally he's arrived in this movie. I wrote a piece for the New York Times about this movie, and it's basically, sort of argues that the Marvel Cinematic Universe has done a really good job of maintaining a consistency of quality, but what they've done has limited their ability to make truly great films. And I think this something like Infinity War kind of suffers from that a little bit. And the movie had been teased in advance as being really, it's a Thanos movie. It's about Thanos. He's the protagonist. And that's not totally wrong. It does kind of start and end on Thanos, and it is about Thanos's journey and his goals, but it's still sort of, it doesn't have quite the, it's a little bit too risk averse to really go all in on being a true, like, this is the villain's story kind of movie in a way that I really wish it would have. a big budget movie with that wasn't quite as risk averse, that wasn't quite so focused on just sort of maintaining, let's make sure this all kind of works and delivers more or less exactly, you know, sort of what you expect and a big twist, kind of a shocking end, you know. And so, you know, this is sort of a, I have real sort of mixed feelings about the Marvel Universe at this point. On the one hand, it's all pretty good. On the other hand, there's a limitation there, which is that it's rarely better than pretty good.
Why is Thanos' chin striated, Peter? And I say this as somebody who's been dealing with Thanos since his early appearances in Iron Man in the early 70s, but
hey,
I've never understood the striated chin.
I don't know that I can explain it except to say, why are Bajoran noses wrinkled?
Hmm. Touché.
Catherine, what science fiction are you reading?
I am going to talk about the fact that, you guys, there is a new Zora Neale Hurston book. There's a new Zora Neale Hurston
wow.
book. There's a new Zora Neale Hurston book. Oh,
wait,
my God.
Wait. What is it?
There's a new Zora Neale Hurston book. So it's called Barracoon, and it was she tried to publish it in the 30s. It was shut down by the haters, who did not like the fact that it was written. It's a nonfiction book. It was written in dialect. The primary speaker is the last man living to have been brought over on a slave ship. It was in dialect. It also exposes a sort of novel thing at the time, which was the role of Africans in the slave trade in the initial enslavement of this person, among many others. Oh, my God, there's a new Zora Neale Hurston book. It's so that exciting. Is, there's
are you,
an excerpt.
Are you a big Their Eyes Were Watching God fan, I assume?
You know, Catherine? I'm more of a big, like, Zora Neale Hurston's gestalt fan. Like, you know, that book was good, but it's more just like her whole story, which is an incredible one. And then the story of her revival as well by Alice Walker. She's a total libertarian, you know, post-hoc libertarian hero to be conscripted by us for sure, except we don't like conscription. And you should read the excerpt in New York Magazine right now. You should buy the book, which will be out next week. You should get stoked for the new Zora Neale Hurston book.
If I may, just very quickly about Zora Neale Hurston, she trained with the famous anthropologist Franz Boas at Columbia, who also trained Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict, who went on to popularize anthropology in the 20th century. I had a graduate seminar once with a professor who was just terrible in general, but Zora Neale Hurston's life ended poorly. And at one point late in her life, when she was essentially working as a maid for a living, and this is somebody who was a really central figure in New York literary circles for a while, particularly Harlem circles, she was accused of having relations with an underage boy. And it was just very, I found it comical. My professor, who was like boosting anybody that he talked about, he was like their best friend and their champion. And he was like, and it was, you know, she wasn't even in the country. There's no way that she could have done it. And he was clearly arguing as if he were in a courtroom trying to exonerate Zora Neale Hurston. And everybody in the seminar was kind of like, hey, you know, it's okay. It's okay. And that's what I always think of when I think of Zora Neale Hurston. And I apologize for that was really not worth the time it took to tell. But
well, I mean, the relevant piece there is that the training, you know, the research methods that she used were ultimately the thing that brought this book down, because she carefully transcribed this man's account of his own life in a kind of phonetic version of his dialect and then used it in print. And I guess at the time it was sort of considered not helpful to the cause, that instead the way that black people speak should have been translated into quote-unquote proper English.
That seems odd, though, because there was also, I mean, Their Eyes Were Watching God. Part of what was loved about it was that it was like ethology. I mean, it was, or ethnography, you know, that it was a legitimate transcription of what was being said. And there were all of these horrible, I can understand why from a black person it would be considered problematic. But I mean, at the same time, there were people like Carl Van Vechten, and cultural critics who were writing books called Nigger Heaven, where they, you know, they traipsed around Harlem and transcribed you know, in the name of the truth, like, you know, step and fetch it type dialect and everything. It's so odd. And she really is one of the great victims of, you know, of patriarchy, of racism, of a prickly personality that didn't. She had like a lot of problems with Langston Hughes at a certain point. It's a shame because, and that Alice Walker essay that kind of recovered her is just a phenomenal from the, it was written in the early 70s. And it was talking about like having crazy ancestors who were just fantastic people that needed to be respected and their graves needed to be tended is one of the metaphors. It's incredibly powerful. And it's also deeply ironic that Hurston was very much of a kind of classical liberal. She was against, she came out against Brown versus Board of Education. She was anti-Roosevelt at various points. That Alice Walker, who's very much of the left, of the progressive left, ended up bringing back this character into American Letters, who had a very different politics. And I think it speaks well to Walker. But certainly her essay and Hurston's work is phenomenally rich. So I didn't know about this, Catherine. I'm really glad that you brought it up.
I want to read about this from one or two or all of you.
I'm reviewing it. Don't you worry about that.
Wow. Wow.
I'm on it.
Dictator much? My cultural consumption over the weekend, expanding the definition of it, took the form of hanging out with and covering and moderating a panel at the Libertarian Party Convention in California, which was a strange and wonderful and kind of energizing even event, the news takeaway of which will appear sometime in the near future at reason.com. But basically, I think Bill Weld is running for president on the LP ticket in 2020. But there's a lot of kind of interesting feedback loops, one of which I'll name a guy I'd met like 15 years ago in a completely different context named Josh Ferguson. Who's running in a recall election. That's kind of a joke election. It's complicated in Fullerton, but he's a huge fan of our Remy videos, and he has a couple of kids. And it, like the kids play their own terrible pop music that he despises, and so he tried to get them into Remy, and that's like the only type of his music that they like. So he's got a four-year-old running around his house singing "People Will Die," apparently to the consternation of other family members. But I just I like to see how the culture can boomerang in interesting ways.
Hey, Matt, is Weld popular among the? Did he have good interactions with the California Libertarians? Because he was such a divisive character, especially towards the end of the 2016 campaign.
Yeah, and so I interviewed him about that in front of the other people. He was people described it as they were surprised by how well he was received. But part of the reason why he was well received is that he's out there endorsing Libertarian Party candidates. He's doing fundraisers for them. There's a guy named Dan Fishman who's pretty good guy running for auditor of the state of Massachusetts statewide election. He has a pretty good chance of winning for a variety of reasons. And, you know, his campaign literature is just a picture of him next to Bill Weld. So he's out there lending his name. He's participating in like ballot access lawsuits or legal actions, raising money, like talking to people. He's got a crew of LP activists that are kind of going with him and reaching out. So he's got more skin in the game at this point in the cycle than Gary Johnson did last time, which is pretty interesting. So if you're going to be engaging in actions, people will respond positively. And he's also he's changed. He's apologized for some of his past inactions, not the going on Rachel Maddow and vouching for Hillary Clinton a week before the election, which is what people are most mad at him for. He still has a kind of explanation for that, which he teased out for those who care about it in an interview I did with him last November. But he's apologized for like what he did in 2006 in the gubernatorial race in New York, which is strange and technical. But also he's become much more hardcore on guns. Now he was sort of a squish before. Now he's like totally bought in. He's on a, you know, a weed company board. He used to be more squishy on weed. So he has moved more in the LP direction. And I think people appreciate that. It would if he decides to do this. And I think he probably will. It will be contested. There will be a contingent The Radical Caucus is not going to welcome him with open arms, I do not think. But it's a big party, and it has a lot of different factions and factionalism. And his presence there, I think, means at least a kind of baseline of national media interest and fundraising abilities. So, yeah, it will be interesting to see whether, you know, the host spits out this thing or not. And I think a lot we'll know a lot more after the national convention, which is in New Orleans right before July 4th, which I'll be going to. And that's the answer to your question. That's all the time of answering questions that we have for here on the Reason Podcast. Again, please subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Stay tuned for the rest of the week as we do other wonderful. Do you know Nick some of what some podcasts are going to be this week? Just to tease the kids.
Yeah. No. I do, and I'm trying to think of that.
But he's not going to tell.
Yeah, no, I know. It, you know, coming up soon, I interviewed Alex Tabarrok, who is one half of Marginal Revolution, the great economics blog. He's a George Mason University economist, and we talked about some of the work he's done recently, where he can't really find the negative economic effects of regulation where he expected to find them. He's one of the most intellectually serious and compelling writers and thinkers in the broad-based libertarian movement. It's a really good conversation. He's also from Canada, so we talk a lot about that and why he kind of feels bad about being an American citizen these days, as opposed to being Canadian. And I also recently talked to Virginia Postrel, a longtime editor of Reason, who's now also writing for Catherine at the magazine. This is part of our 50th anniversary series, where we're talking to all the past editors of Reason to, you know, just get a sense of what was going on at the time they were editor and whether or not our take was particularly prescient or relevant. And it's really a fascinating conversation because, you know, libertarians are always being kind of pilloried for not being pragmatic or not being in the mix of things. But some of the stuff she was talking about, which I hadn't thought about in a long time, like biomedical revolution stuff in the 1990s, like that has just been proceeding apace. And it's not even controversial anymore, like a lot of the stuff that we were fighting over in the 90s. And it's this place where libertarians were there first, and we are, you know, but we get no credit for that, even as these things become, you know, part and parcel of our everyday life. So that's also in the pipeline.
Are you telling me, Nick, that we can't just thank Joe Biden for gay marriage? Is that what you're telling me, Nick?
Yeah, I'm going up. Really, I'm off the reservation on that one. Yeah, it is just, you know, I mean, and this is something as people are recognizing, you know, we're doing a lot of 50th anniversary events and presentations and whatnot. We're going to have a huge presence at Freedom Fest, the annual libertarian gathering in Las Vegas in mid-July. And people should go to the website and look for ways to see what we're doing there and decide whether or not to come. But it's, you know, 50 years of Reason, it's a long time, and we have a lot to be, I think, very proud of. And we were, you know, talking about a lot of stuff that has become common in America long before people were thinking about it.
Awesome. Well, let's end on that note. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and subscribe and keep on listening. Thank you.